So Halloween is a few days away. In many American communities, children will dress up in costumes and go door to door, requesting treats and threatening tricks. Hundreds of witch costumes are sold for both children and adults, including this toddler girl's purple moon costume, which you can get for only $39.99. Or if you're an adult, you can get the adult seductive sorceress witch costume for only $132.99. Now, as a child, I learned from the oral tradition of children how to play tricks on others. I learned the trick of ringing a neighbor's doorbell on Halloween. We would run and hide in the bushes and watch them respond to the sound. Why did we do it? We were rebels, establishing our independent identity. We were separating ourselves from the adults, dressed in costume, walking the streets in darkness. We felt liberated from the rules imposed on us by grown-ups. When I was a child, I knew nothing of the origins of Halloween. My parents raised me as a Unitarian Universalist, so I knew nothing of the Roman Catholic holy day called All Saints' Day. With this ignorance, when I was 20, I traveled to France on October 31st, and I got on a train in Luxembourg to go to Paris, and I was struck by the fact that there were no seats left and there were people standing in the aisles. I thought, well, what could possibly be going on? It was a beginning of All Saints Day, which would be November 1st, and it's a huge holiday in France, a huge holy day in which people travel home to be with their families. And when I got to Paris, all the hotels were taken. It was an introduction to All Saints Day for a 20-year-old who was exploring Europe. Later on, I learned that Halloween is a hallowed evening observed the night before All Saints Day. But who were the witches? Well, women Unitarian Universalist ministers had to educate me on this question. They explained to me that before Christianity dominated Europe, people lived in the area we now call Germany, and that they credited women with special powers to predict the future. For example, it's documented that a German army did not attack Julius Caesar's army as expected because the matrons in the German army had pronounced that the attack would be unsuccessful if it started before the next full moon. Caesar's historian added that making such decisions were customary for such women. And in the next century, a Roman historian reported that the Germans regarded women as endowed with some spiritual power that gave them the ability to see the future. The German people, the tribes and villages respected their most famous prophetic women as living goddesses. In other parts of Northern Europe, in Scandinavia, in Greenland, Iceland, in Siberia, medieval stories described women who would go into a trance while on a raised platform. The women would dress in decorative costumes. A group of women followers would sit around their leader as she took her place on the ceremonial platform. And in the trance, she would give advice to the people about the future. These women would travel from village to village. Landowners sought their services to predict the weather or learn the future of their household members. Like the Germans, the people in these northern European villages showed reverence for the women as possessors of prophetic wisdom. Now, these accounts from the pre-Christian peoples who lived in the lands we now call Germany and Northern Europe suggest that 2,000 years ago, women had important leadership roles. Did these stories of these powerful women evolve to become the witches of the Middle Ages? Now, historians cannot say this for certain, because there is a gap in the written records. There are no historic accounts between the 5th and the 9th centuries describing such female leaders. After this 400-year gap, historians have found a Christian text, a canon written in the 9th century, that describes and denounces a roving group of powerful females. One passage refers to a story that on particular nights, women would ride across the world on animals with Diana, the Roman goddess of nature. The 9th century document ordered priests to tell their congregations that this story was a demonic delusion. Now, after the 9th century, there is a great deal of written evidence describing a widespread belief in a benevolent company of powerful women who traveled at night. In Gaul, what we now call France, the image was of three stately women. In paintings, they are often holding dishes of bread, fruit, or flowers as a sign of prosperity and abundance. Because of the gap between the 5th and the 9th centuries, it's difficult to prove a direct connection between the stories of leadership of women in pre-Christian societies and the stories of powerful mythical women in the Middle Ages. We do know that from about the 9th century until the 14th century, the folk tales about powerful women existed right alongside the Christian religion. The documents describing those who believed in the old folk tales, the documents by the Christians describe those who believed in the old folk tales as ignorant people, but not evil people. This started to change around 1300. Belief in the stories of wise, kind, powerful women who traveled at night, this became more than an ignorant belief. It was labeled as heresy. Some priests, leaders of a particular movement called the Observant, wanted to purge Christianity of all laxity, of all ungodliness. These priests divided the world between good and evil in a very rigid way. In sermons, these male clergy distorted the old folk story traditions by creating the story of the demonic witches who had supernatural powers that they got from a male devil. The clerics told about women who would fly at night, who would assemble in groups and conduct devil worship ceremonies, often involving blood sucking and cannibalism of babies. For these alleged activities, from 1424 until 1782, at least 40,000 people were legally put to death for the crime of witchcraft. About three quarters of these 40,000, at least 30,000 who were executed, were women. It was a time of hysteria and paranoia. In an insane attempt to purify the Christian faith, fanatical people took out their fears and anxieties on others. Looking today at the surviving court records, the women whom the authorities killed were ordinary people. Some were bad neighbors, were quarrelsome, Some were inclined to curse and insult. But many were normal women who happened to have the wrong friends or enemies at the wrong moment. They were accused, arrested, tortured to get confessions, tried, and executed. The fanaticism spread to America. And in 1692, the most famous of all the American witch hunts occurred in the village of Salem, Massachusetts. It began when teenage girls started to have fits. The parents of one girl observed her during a family prayer. The girl's head was upright and her eyes were fixed in a death-like stare. If her parents questioned her, she would make hoarse, choking sounds. Another girl started to get down on all fours and run through the house, barking and braying. She sometimes fell into convulsions in which she withered and screamed. These behaviors spread to several other teenage women in Salem. Today, researchers have theories about what may have contributed to the fits of these young women. 24 young female accusers were over the age of 16, but still single. Of the 21 from whom information is available, 17 had lost one or both of their parents. At least 13 had lost their fathers. These parental deaths resulted largely from war-related Indian attacks. Some of these young women had even witnessed one or both of their parents' violent deaths. As orphans, families in Salem took them in as servants. The frontier wars that had taken the lives of their parents left the women without dowries. Because few men were interested in marrying women without dowries, their marriage prospects were grim. Simultaneously, Puritan culture officially discouraged sexual activity outside of marriage. The community held a woman who had sexual relations with a man who was not her husband responsible for both the sin and the consequences. In addition, as female servants, they were the most common objects of sexual advances and sexual harassment. Finally, religious training was most pious in the homes of the female accusers. So the women who played the accusing roles in the Salem witch hunt tended to be single, orphaned, poor, and pious servants. On the other hand, most of the persons attacked as witches in Salem were middle-aged women or old women eligible for inheritances because they had no brothers or sons. Along with their potential economic power, the women accused of being witches tended to be those who questioned the authority of the Puritan church. That particular church eventually saw the light and converted to Unitarianism and still exists in Salem today. At the trials, witnesses often cited hostility to the Puritan church or clergy as evidence of witchcraft. Some women even questioned the subservient role of women in Puritan society. These records show that women accused of witchcraft tended to be involved in petitions and court suits involving property or mistreatment or divorce. Anger was a common complaint against the women charged with witchcraft. Causing illness was also a common charge. Some accused women were working as midwives, women who worked in competition with male doctors. In 1692, the hysterical anxieties of the young, single, orphaned women, the need for power and control of the male clergy and judges, and the self-assertion and pride of a few older Salem women all of this came together in a deadly mixture. Over the spring and summer of 1692, the hysterical young woman accused nearly 200 persons of witchcraft. 75% were women. In public hangings between June and September of 1692, the sheriff of Salem executed 14 women and 5 men. Now today, I find it strange that men who are upset about being investigated often complain that they are the victims of a witch hunt. A male filmmaker warns of a witch hunt atmosphere surrounding the storm of sexual harassment allegations against a male studio executive. Now, of course, everyone should have the right to a fair investigation and a fair trial, where rules govern the presentation of evidence. Still, I think it odd that men feel they can claim the role of victim by appropriating the phrase witch hunt. The phrase witch hunting is from the 1630s and originally described the execution by men of 30,000 innocent women. Out of respect for their memory and the memory of the 14 women executed in Salem, I do not casually use the words witch hunt. The potential for the sort of hysteria found in Salem is still in each one of us. Under great stress, brought on by the death, perhaps, of a close friend or relative, stress brought on by financial losses, under great stress, we also can become paranoid. A man's fear of assertive women can win out. This fear can win out over our reason. Our anxiety can win out over our courage. Under great stress, our fears can become the raw material for hysteria. I ask myself, what fear might cause me to abandon my reason? When the stress on me becomes too great, what prejudices lie in me ready for the paranoid person to exploit? What private insecurity inside me could lure me into joining a mob? What great stress could overcome my better judgment? The layer of civilization in all of us is thin. Only self-knowledge and self-understanding protect us from getting caught up in our fears and our prejudices. Prejudice against women remains a part of the Halloween tradition. Years ago, when my 2 sons were young and were talking about what they wanted to be for Halloween, they did not want to be witches, they announced, because witches were bad, evil women who did cruel, bad things. That's not true, I said to my boys. The women who we call witches were women who wanted the freedom to be strong and independent and live their own lives. They did not do harm to anyone. But because they wanted to be free and strong and self-reliant, hundreds of years ago, some of these women were killed. Today, the word witch is one of the very few words to describe independent female power. My sons were shocked by what I told them. A few days before Halloween, my 10-year-old son said, "Dad, I told the boys at school what you said about witches not being evil." They all agreed you were wrong. "I'm not wrong," I said. "Your friends at school are misinformed. Witches were not evil." He went away confused. Who was right, his friends or his dad? Each year, I enjoy the ritual of Halloween. I watch the young as they slip on the disguises, as they take on unconventional identities, as they shout and giggle in the October night, as they brazenly challenge a grown-up with trick or treat. A joy can be heard in their voices. Like the women who were called witches centuries ago, the children are yearning to develop their own strong personal identities. The dressing up and the tricks in the night are part of the process. It is a continuation of an ancient ritual. So with a smile on my face and a handful of candy, I join in the old religion. Happy Halloween.